So, one of the principles then of Buddhism is a principle that attachment hurts, and non-attachment is a form of happiness. So I want to talk a little bit this evening about attachment, and I want to do it by referring to a sutta, a discourse of the Buddha, from the middle-length discourses, which I think is among the more humorous of the discourses of the Buddha. He's not known for being a comedian, but there are some things that seem humorous, and to a trained eye, they're more humorous than to the untrained eye. But this discourse has to do with Shaka. Shaka is the king of the gods. Sometimes the same role as Brahma has, the king of the Indian pantheon of gods. And this king of the gods decides to go visit the Buddha and asks the Buddha the following: "Venerable sir, how in brief is a monk liberated by the destruction of craving? How is a monk one who has reached the ultimate end, the ultimate security, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate goal, one who is foremost among gods and humans?" Someone who's attained enlightenment in Buddhist point of view has a higher status than even the gods, even the highest of gods, even the great Shaka. So it's foremost among gods and have. So he's asking, what does it take to become fully awakened or awakened? But he wants to know the answer in brief. So what's his intention? What does he want to know? So then the Buddha responds. And the first line is repeated. It appears elsewhere in the canon, but gets repeated sometimes as being kind of the kernel or the epitome of what the Buddha had to teach, or one of the kind of very core teachings of what it's all about. If you had to reduce Buddhism to one phrase, it could be reduced to this phrase here. The phrase is, "Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to." That's the phrase. So that phrase then appears in this teachings by the Buddha. "Here," the Buddha says, "ruler of gods, a monk who has heard that nothing is worth clinging to, having heard this, he or she directly knows everything. Having directly known everything, he or she fully understands everything. Having fully understood everything, whatever feeling he or she feels, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, he or she abides contemplating impermanence in these feelings." So the monk hears this teaching that nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to, nothing whatsoever is worth being attached to. And then the Buddha makes this interesting statement. Having heard this, the person knows everything. Now he's telling it to Shaka, the great, you know, great, it's like telling, you know, our God, you know, the great, you know, creator on his throne, you know. This is, you know, if you know this one thing, you know everything. If you don't know this one thing, maybe what you know is not very much. And what the Buddha means here by knowing everything, not that the person is omniscient and that they can know every possible thing, but he knows something essential about everything. He knows what's essential to know about everything from the point of view of spiritual liberation. You know that everything, or that nothing at all, nothing whatsoever, is worth clinging to. Now it takes a lot of convincing that that's the case, because if that was easy to believe, all of us would be, you know, fully enlightened. But many of us think that it's very well worthwhile clinging to something, otherwise we wouldn't be doing it. So by knowing this one thing, you know everything. Then knowing this one thing, somehow that translates to being able to understand the impermanence of our feelings, of whether things are pleasant or unpleasant, the impermanence of our likes and dislikes. That I don't know exactly how that translates directly, but the Buddha seems to claim that having this understanding that nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to leads to the understanding that things are impermanent. Suggestion is that probably the perception of permanence, that things are permanent, entails some kind of clinging, some kind of illusion that we hold on to, that things are actually going to stay fixed in that whatever way we're holding on to them. And then, as a matter of course, the person then will become fully awakened. Once they start seeing the impermanence of things, their attachments will start fading away. So the first they're here, there's no clinging, that nothing's worthwhile clinging to. They apply this understanding to their experience. They start seeing things as being impermanent. And as they see the things being impermanent, the desire to hold on to those things or resist them or cling to them begins to fade away. And as those fade away entirely, then there's the experience of Nibbana or Nirvana. Nibbana being defined as a total destruction of greed, hate, and delusion, the total destruction of craving, of attachment. So, Shaka, the ruler of gods, delighting and rejoicing in the Buddha's words, paid homage to the Buddha, and keeping him to his right, he vanished at once. He's a god, right? So he just vaporizes. And so he was delighted and rejoiced. So he asked for the teaching in brief, he heard it in brief, and he was really delighted. Then Mahamoggallana, who was one of the Buddha's primary disciples, wondered, this god, did he really penetrate the meaning of what the Buddha had to say when he rejoiced, or did he not? Did he really get it or not? Suppose I find out. So, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm, that fast, not that I'm strong, but the venerable Mahamoggallana vanished from the palace from where he was and appeared among the gods of the 33, of the gods of the 33, it says here, in the heaven of the 33 gods. It's kind of one of the highest heavens where Brahma, where Shaka lives. So now, at that time, Shaka was furnished and endowed 100-fold with the 5 kinds of heavenly music. So that's pretty good. I mean, just any kind of heavenly music is good, but 100-fold of it. Because one of the delights of being born as a god, is that you get a lot of pleasure. You know, all the sensual pleasures. You know, the higher you go in the heavenly realms, the greater the amount of sensual pleasure there is. And you know, some of the lower ones, it's a lot of sexual pleasure. So you get, you know, you get not just your favorite partner there, but you get 100 of them. And but as you go higher, it gets more sublime, because sexual pleasure isn't as sublime as some of the other possibilities. And so anyway, so he's there sitting there with 5 kinds of heavenly music. And he was enjoying it in the pleasure park of the single lotus. That's where he lives, the pleasure park of the single lotus. When he saw that the venerable Mahamoggallana was coming, he dismissed the music, went to the venerable Mahamoggallana, and said, great, it's nice to see you. It's been a long time since I've seen you. Welcome. So the venerable Moggallana sat down and asked Shakya, how was it that the Buddha told you in brief how one attains deliverance, liberation, through the destruction of craving and attachment? What did the Buddha tell you when you asked your question? So this is interesting, the answer. Good sir, Moggallana, we are so busy. We have so much to do, not only with our own business, but also with the business of the other gods. Besides, so here he was, you know, enjoying the music, hanging out at his pleasure park, right, when Mogalanus shows up. He says, oh, I'm too busy to tell you. Besides, good sir, what is well heard, well learned, well attended to, well remembered, does not vanish all of a sudden. So he's saying, I remember what the Buddha told me, but I'm too busy to tell you what it was. Good sir, it once happened that war broke out between the gods and the Titans. In that war, the gods won and the Titans were defeated. When I had won that war and returned from it as a conqueror, I had a great palace built. Good sir, that great palace has 100 towers, and each tower has 700 upper chambers. And each upper chamber has 7 nymphs. And each nymph has 7 maids. So this is his pleasure park. Would you like to see the loveliness of this great palace? So he takes as much time for him to explain the delights of this pleasure palace as it would have been to repeat the Buddha's words, which he doesn't have any time to teach, to repeat. And now he's going to take him on a tour of his palace. So then Mogalanana says, sure. Then they went there, and when the maids saw Shaka coming with Venerable Mahamogalana, they were embarrassed and ashamed, and they went each into their own rooms. I don't know if embarrassed and ashamed is the right translation, but just as a daughter-in-law is embarrassed and ashamed on seeing her father-in-law, so too those maids, when they saw Mahamogalana coming, were embarrassed and ashamed and went into their own rooms. So I don't know what that, you know, Indian culture, what that kind of embarrassment is, but that's how they felt. Then Shakya, the ruler of gods, showed him everything, and Mahamogalana was a very nice guest. He said, this is great. You're lucky. This is really the result of a lot of good karma that you did in the past, a lot of good merit. This is great. Then the Venerable Mahamogalana considered thus. He had his own private thoughts. This god is living much too negligently. What have I stirred up a sense of urgency in him? So this guy is just indulging in pleasure, you know. He's indulging in his pleasure so much. He's so busy with his business of pleasure that he can't even repeat the Buddha's, you know, very profound teachings, that nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. So Mahamogalana wants to do something about that. So he wants to bring a sense of urgency, spiritual urgency to him. So Mahamogalana performed such a feat of supernormal power that with a point of his toe, so you have to imagine he kind of sticks out his toe like this, you know, wiggles it, I guess. In the movies, the witch wiggles her nose. In Buddhism, you wiggle your toe. And he made that great palace quake and shake and tremble. Shaka and the other gods were filled with wonder and amazement, and they said, sirs, it is wonderful, it is marvelous, what power and what might that recluse has, that with a point of his toe he makes the heavenly region shake and quake and tremble. So he's gotten their attention now. So then he says, Mahamogalana says, now, what was it the Buddha told you? And then Mahamogalana said, oh, okay. This is what he said. He said, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. And so then Mahamogalana was satisfied. But then he went back to the Buddha to confirm with the Buddha whether that's actually what the Buddha had said to Shaka. And the Buddha said, yes, in fact, Shaka got it right. Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. And that's the end of this particular story. So do you think it was kind of funny? So, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. So this is a very challenging teaching, because many of us feel like something is worth clinging to. But nothing whatsoever. So a lot of what we do in Buddhist practice is to study what is it we cling to, and then in that process become aware of the cost of clinging. And if we start doing a cost-benefit analysis, you probably find, if you have a dharma eye, and that's part of what meditation practice is developing, is a dharma eye, you'll see that the cost-benefit analysis comes out in favor of not clinging. That whatever benefits that come from clinging never match the benefits that come from not clinging. Now, some people understand the danger and the suffering inherent in clinging and grasping and resisting. If you're sensitive, you can feel it in the very moment. Just to very put up your hands like that, and your hands hurt a little bit. It's kind of like tense. Or if you grab for something, it's kind of tense. The mind does that, the heart does that. In and of itself, that's a tense movement, a contracted movement, which has suffering in and of itself right there. And there's a lot of other forms of suffering that are inherent in our attachments. And so some people recognize that, and they see the wisdom of maybe learning to relax their clinging, because they see the tremendous cost of clinging. Other people see the great benefits of not clinging. So it's not so much a matter. Then it's not so much a matter of going away from the suffering of clinging, as it is being pulled towards or going towards the great delight of not clinging. Now, I think that a lot of people who come to Buddhist practice, they start off maybe more on the kind of feeling their suffering, and saying, "Oh, maybe there's an alternative to my suffering. Let me see if I can let go of that suffering." But as the practice deepens, at some point there's a kind of gravitational force that sets into place where a person really sees the great benefits and the great delight, the great value of being in a state of non-clinging. In fact, it's kind of like a gravitational force. At some point you're in that gravitational force of non-clinging, and you just pull at some point. It's not even that you really want to necessarily. It's like water flowing downhill. And there's a kind of, it's kind of a moment, a divide in practice, where you're no longer primarily under the gravitational force of clinging, but you're more under the gravitational force of non-clinging. For most people who don't understand the great power of non-clinging, there's a gravitational force to clinging. And it's very easy to be sucked into that and pulled into it and enthusiastic about it. Like Shakya, who's so enthusiastic about his pleasures. I thought about this sutta today because of September 11th. The earth shook for all of us, and many of us looked at our lives in a new way, in a deep way, and were changed in some way or other by that event. And now it's been a few months since then, and how much of the power and strength of how you were changed and sensitized and moved by those events, how much are still present for you? I've had people tell me things like, "I don't want to, I've had enough of that. I don't want to hear anything more about September 11th or anything related to it." And they want to go back to business as usual. America is the great heavenly realm. It's probably there's no civilization in the world that qualifies as a heavenly realm in some senses of the term, as America. And every once in a while we have something that stirs us up and brings a sense of spiritual urgency. And then how easy is it to slip back? Shaka had the great wisdom to go to the Buddha and ask for teachings, though he asked for it briefly. The American way, quickly. And he got it. And then he went back to business as usual, to his pleasure and his delight. So sometimes we're actually quite blessed to have the earth shake for us And there's individual ways and collective ways that happens. And they're really important opportunities in life. Sometimes they're unparalleledly important opportunities when the earth shakes for us. And do we take that opportunity to be changed? Or do we really look deeply into our life? Or do we go back to business as usual, when business as usual maybe is not so deeply satisfying? So the question of where our deepest satisfaction lies has to do with this issue of clinging and non-clinging. If it just sounds like all you're supposed to do in Buddhist practice is give up your clinging, as if there's no benefits in doing that, it can seem kind of, you know, why bother? Why, you know, it just doesn't have the real, you know, it seems kind of blank. You kind of, if I don't cling, then where's my creative juices going to come from? Where's my joy in life or my passion going to be? And so it just seems like you become kind of a dull, plain, you know, your person if you just let go of your clinging. But if you can feel the tremendous satisfaction and delight and deep happiness of a state of non-clinging, then it can be really, it's really something you want then in a healthy way, hopefully. It's something that seems really appealing and attractive and interesting. Non-clinging is not supposed to be meant as kind of a dry event, but it's something really wonderful. The Buddha said, if you can let go of a lesser happiness in order to attain a greater happiness, you'd be a fool not to let go of the lesser happiness. So what happens, I think, often with clinging and with desire, often in general, is that there can be pleasure or the promise or the hope for pleasure in desires, in various forms of clinging. But often it kind of masks the deepest form of satisfaction and desire which is possible. And because it masks it, we don't know the deeper form of satisfaction is available to us. And so then we stay satisfied with the more surface joys and satisfaction of our life. It's kind of like that cartoon of Charlie Brown, I think, is talking to Linus. And Charlie says, oh, my father really really understands how to take care of cars really well. He's a good mechanic or whatever. And just the other day, there was this terrible clanking sound coming out of the engine. And Linus says, oh, don't tell me he stopped the car and fixed it. And Charlie says, oh, no. He just turned up the radio. And the radio maybe is really pleasant to listen to, but it masks, you know, the problem. And so part of the illusion of many of the things we cling to is that they promise certain kind of satisfaction and happiness, and they're not to be said they're not sometimes satisfying, but sometimes mask the possibility of some deeper, inherent, native peace and happiness which lies within us. So, from my experience, when I have been able to drop down or sense the inherent satisfaction or peace or happiness of just being or just being alive, when just being is enough, it's very interesting to start paying attention to what shifts as my attachments come back into play, my clinging. And what I found is that when I start clinging and attaching, it's actually kind of deadening. From the perspective of having this very deep subtleness and joy and satisfaction in life, when you discover the kingdom within, if you use Christian terms, then from the point of the kingdom within, attachment begins to darken over that kingdom. It kind of deadens it. Now, that can seem like bad news to talk that way, but actually it's supposed to be very good news to realize that, you know, then I realize, oh, why bother with the attachments? Why lose something that's so precious by coloring it over with clinging to something? One of the sad things about that can happen with desire, if a person has too much desire or too much clinging, is that it's usually, almost always perhaps, takes us away from ourselves. there's an object to the clinging, an object to the desire, an object to the resistance, which is external to the pure subject, the pure subjective sense of happiness or delight or peace, which is innate in who we are. And so we're focusing away from our essence, in a sense, by looking for a desire. Desire is about something, filling something in the future, or holding on to something, clinging to something, kind of external, in a sense, from pure subject. And so the more we get caught up in that clinging and that desire, the more we become estranged from this innate sense of subject or peace or well-being that's within us. And then we feel somehow uncomfortable. We feel like we lack something, or feel certain. You feel estranged from ourselves, even. And that feels uncomfortable, and so we feel uncomfortable. So we try to fix that discomfort by wanting something else. So there can be a vicious cycle with desire that keeps us alienated from ourselves. And it can be desire about anything. I've noticed it with the kind of desires I can have. I would like to have a new car. And I've noticed sometimes I'm driving on the freeway and I notice other cars and I start kind of thinking and ruminating about cars. And when I really pay attention to that, if I get lost in that process, if then I pay attention to it again, what's going on with me, I feel that it's been deadening to myself. There's energy in it, but the energy is kind of nervous and agitated or deadening, or it doesn't really allow me to rest in the innate sense of well-being that's possible for all of us. So in Buddhism, we talk about entering the stream. Someone who's really entered the first kind of really and entered into the Dharma practice in a very deep way is said to enter the stream, become a stream enterer. And then the stream begins to carry them along. And one of the ways I understand this is when your sense, your experience, your awareness of the innate satisfaction of non-clinging is starting to become compelling. When you really get a taste of that, and you start living under the gravitational force of that, you open yourself up to the possibility of being in the gravitational force of non-clinging. So you're leaning in that direction, you're being pulled in that direction, you're interested in that direction. It has value for you. Maybe it has the highest value for you to not to cling. I'll give you one example, small example, of how this works, and then I'll stop. So I give a lot of these talks, right? And public talking is supposed to be one of the great fears that people have. And people, many people, how many of you would be nervous you have to sit up here and give a talk in front of this group of people? You wouldn't like it, huh? So I'm kind of like all of you, but I've gotten used to it. I've done it long enough. But in the early years when I gave talks, I used to start thinking about what I was going to talk about or plan it or ruminate about it while I was sitting here in front of you all. And I almost never do it anymore. And the reason is that it's more innately satisfying for me and has greater value and priority for me to rest in my own sense of well-being or peacefulness than it is to be anxious or concerned or planning what I should be talking about. So at least in this one little domain, maybe because I've done it so much, I've caught that bug. I've gotten hooked by the value and the importance of non-clinging. So I'm not so likely to get clinging to the Dharma talk in the 45 minutes before I'm going to give it. Isn't that nice? I hope you think it's nice, because unless you think, he'd do a better job. I wish he would. So those are my thoughts for today. So what are your thoughts hearing that? We have a couple of minutes for you to respond. Yes? Well, that's an interesting question. It's a little bit, for me personally, it's a little bit of a complex question. But or it's very simple. I don't know, depending on the angle. But the if we have mixed motives in wanting to be of service, it might be a horrible thing to give up the good deed because we feel that there's a little bit of mixed motives in it. So if you feel so you have some attachment there, it might still be worthwhile to help someone. Just realize you're attached and try to work with it. Though sometimes when there's attachment connected, it can cause all kinds of negative ramifications way beyond the particular person you've been helping. One of the teachings in Buddhism is that one of the teachings of the Buddha is, he said, never give up your own welfare for the sake of someone else's welfare, no matter how great. So that's a very challenging teaching for some of us. But the Buddha, he's very explicit, he said, never give up your own welfare for the sake of someone else's welfare, no matter how great. But the perspective of the Buddha for that was, what he meant by welfare there was not a bigger bank account or, you know, something. But what he meant there was your ultimate spiritual welfare, your own deep liberation, your own entering the stream of the Dharma. And the reason he said that, I believe, is that if you really take care of your own spiritual welfare that way, then you can offer, then you're in the position to offer someone else the greatest benefit in return. The analogy the Buddha used was that if everyone is stuck in quicksand, it's very hard for anyone in the quicksand to help other people out. But if one person can get up on dry land, that person can pull the other people out. So from the point of view of the Buddha, who was always focused on the greatest welfare of people, not just simply, you know, other things. So for example, in my own case, I spent a year reflecting on when I was living at the Tassajara Zen Monastery. I guess I was about 26, 27, wondering what to do with my life. I was living in a monastery, and I had been accepted to UC Berkeley to graduate school. To study soil conservation, because I saw that soil erosion was one of the great problems in the world, and I felt it was really something I wanted to respond to. With, I had a background in agriculture, farming, and I spent a year thinking about this. And what I came to was that, for me, I'm not saying this is the right decision for anyone else, but for me, that as long as I was going to be helping people with issues of soil erosion, that I would feel a dissatisfaction, because I knew that what was going to be most satisfying for me was to try to address suffering at its deepest roots. If I wasn't addressing it at the deepest roots, I would always be felt like it wasn't enough, or I wasn't satisfied, or something. Even though I was able to maybe help, you know, grow lots of food for people, those people could still be quite filled with suffering, as we know right here in Palo Alto, where lots of people are well fed, but we suffer a lot. And so I felt it was really important for me to be able to try to address suffering at its root, which meant staying in the practice the best I could and offering that. So I feel quite inadequate in the way I've answered your question. It was a very good one. And maybe some other time we can go into it a little bit more depth. Kind of rambled a little bit.